This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Macro Voices, episode 237, was recorded on September 17th, 2020. I'm Eric Townsend. This episode is brought to you by TopTradersUnplugged.com, a podcast dedicated to quant and rules-based investing, helping investors overcome behavioral biases, and by FarmTogether.com, bringing farmland, a new trillion-dollar investment opportunity within reach of all accredited investors. JDI Research founder Juliet DeClercq is back as this week's feature interview guest. We'll discuss the potential outcomes of the U.S. presidential election and their impact on markets, inflation, the U.S. dollar, and much more. Then be sure to stay tuned for our post-game segment after the feature interview. Patrick's chart book this week is titled, Is That the Best the Bulls Can Do? And we'll revisit those 50-day moving averages that we talked about last week and see how a number of different stocks and other markets are performing compared to the levels that we discussed in last week's post-game. And a quick housekeeping note, Macro Voices will be released on Wednesday, the 23rd of September next week, instead of our usual Thursday schedule, in order to accommodate travel schedules.
And I'm Patrick Serezna. Now, Eric, that S&P 500 was quite oversold last week when we were talking, and it did muster up a bounce, and yet here we are back to levels where we were trading last week. What's your take on the S&P 500 here?
Well, clearly that relief rally, or maybe you just want to call it a dead cat bounce, failed today. And it really remains to be seen as to whether we get to a new lower low, which would be the next technical signal. I still think the big story is going to be, from now to the election and really through Inauguration Day, is going to be the escalation of unrest, which I expect to occur, and a very likely contested election. What that means for markets, you know, and uncertainty is usually not good for markets. It remains to be seen. I'm going to ask more and more of our guests about the presidential election outlook, and particularly the potential implications of a contested election where nobody knows who the president of the United States actually is for potentially several weeks after Election Day. And we'll start that with Juliet DeClercq in today's interview.
All right, well, let's move on to the U.S. dollar, because obviously the U.S. dollar has been in a substantial downtrend for the last 5+ months. But really, we are going on almost 2 months of the dollar index being pinned in this kind of 92.5 to 93.5 tight range. Which way does it break out from here?
Well, we're still consolidating. There's no confirmation in either direction yet from a technical standpoint. So it's a coiled up market. I think it's probably ready to make a significant move one direction or the other. If we do see a dramatic increase of civil unrest in the United States, and particularly if more people develop the opinion that I have, which is that a contested election, a very strongly contested election, is essentially a certainty at this point, that maybe could be quite bearish. On the other hand, there's a lot of reasons to expect that dollar squeeze thesis to play out. So I really don't have any conviction on which way, but I definitely think this market is coiling up, ready to move one way or the other.
All right, well, let's move on to crude oil, Eric. And I just have one question. Was that a buy on dip?
Well, you know, until today, Patrick, my base case was that we were only halfway done with the downside move that was in play. I was targeting somewhere in the low 30s for WTI. Now, we had a rally off of what would be a reasonable, you know, halfway through the move, you tend to get that counter trend rally. That's what I thought was going on until today. And inventory certainly helped with the rally this week, crude oil drawing down 4.4 million barrels. And it's really 6.5 million barrels if you include the additional 2.2 million barrel drawdown on the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, which I think is really commercial oil, not government oil that's coming out. Cushing, Oklahoma, drawing down 74,000 barrels. Gasoline drawing down 381,000 barrels. Distillates was the one build on the board this week, and it was a big one, 3.5 million barrels. Now, U.S. production is way back up, almost a million barrels on the week. But of course, what that really is we're bouncing back to pre-tropical storm levels, actually a couple hundred thousand barrels higher. Pre-tropical storm, we were at 10.7. Now we've not only regained that, but we're even a couple hundred thousand barrels higher. The tape action in response to inventory was fairly strong, and it really got stronger today on Thursday. Now, Patrick, if I was looking at this market purely from a technical standpoint, I would say, look, there's a really strong argument here that, you know, it's a technical breakout to the upside. The correction is over. That's it. The bottom is in. We're headed back to a new cycle highs above 43. That's what the technical read of the tape tells me. The thing is, today was the meeting of OPEC Plus, the Joint Ministerial Monitoring Committee, and their press conference included quite a bit of rhetoric, kind of trying to scare shorts out of the marketplace. There's a possibility that what we're seeing today, because OPEC is so good at jawboning the oil market, that this was the OPEC jawbone. Maybe it's not going to last. Maybe tomorrow it's all going to reverse. And that really was the top of a counter trend rally. And we've still got more downside before we're done, which was my original base case. I'll tell you though, Patrick, if it turns out that this was really it, that the long awaited, after 2 months of a coiling market, all we got was a sell-off down to not even $36. It only lasted a week or so, and we're already retracing. If we go from here back to above $43, moving toward a new cycle high, it really, to me, just cements an incredibly bullish longer-term outlook, because the prediction that Art Berman shared with us back in June when we last interviewed him hasn't even begun to play out yet. Remember what Art told us was expect over the course of the summer through the end of Q2 that you might see a downside move in the market like the one we just saw, though I think both Art and I thought it would be a bigger one than the one we just saw. But he said, just wait for Q4. That's when we're going to have consumed the inventory of drilled but uncompleted wells. We'll get to the point where the dramatically lower rig count catches up with us, and you'll see U.S. production fall off a cliff in Q4. Now, right now, we've got U.S. production back up to 10.9 million barrels, 200,000 higher than before the tropical storm. So there's no sign of U.S. production falling off a cliff. If Art is right about that, and of course he said it wouldn't start until sometime in Q4, if he's right about that and we're already seeing this much strength in the market, I think as we get toward the end of 2020 and into the new year, we're going to be looking at sharply higher prices. Still remains to be seen, though, whether or not this is really over the way it feels like today, or if maybe this is a pop and drop as a result of the OPEC JMMC press conference, which certainly seems to have scared the shorts out of the market.
All right. Well, let's get your take on gold, because gold really, over the, just very similar to the dollar, gold has been more or less in a $50 range for almost 2 months. It's been just in the sideways range, and we're right in the middle of that range, around $1,150. I mean, it doesn't seem to want to commit either direction. What's your take on all of this?
Well, and it's also in a wedge or triangle formation, depending on how you want to interpret the chart, which means, you know, eventually it runs out of time. It breaks through one trend line or the other. We did briefly on Wednesday, at least on an intraday basis, gold poked its head above that top trend line, the resistance line, but didn't get a close there. So it really wasn't a signal. And, you know, now we're back in the middle of that zone. We need to see a daily close above 1972 or below 1910 in order for me to interpret that the consolidation pattern that you just described has finally ended. Can't go on for too much longer. These trend lines converge. They eventually come to a point. We got to come out on one side or the other. I'm still hoping it's a downside resolution, because as a gold bull, I want to buy more at a lower price. But I really do think that this market has gone too far too fast to the upside. And I think that the more consolidation and downside corrections that we get, the more it just increases the longer term health of this secular bull market in gold.
All right, and let's wrap up by talking about that 10-year Treasury yield, which, like the other markets, is in the sideways trade range for at least a month now, pinned somewhere around this 68 basis point area, give or take. Which way are we going to break?
I have no opinion short term, as our long term listeners know. I think the real question is, can we get to negative yields? Is that possible? And can we get to a secular shift to inflation? If so, how long will it take to bring about? I'm leaning more and more toward the inflation is coming view. I'm convinced inflation is coming. I just can't decide if it's the next quarter or 3 years from now before it really starts to hit the tape in a big way. Let's see what Juliette DeClercq says in the feature interview.
All right, well, this week's feature interview guest is JDI Research founder Juliette DeClercq. Now, Eric, why did we invite Juliette back onto the show this week?
Patrick, Juliette has been a listener favorite for years, and it's been too long since we've had her on the show. She's also really good with fixed income markets. She's made a lot of good treasury calls. I wanted to ask her about inflation, and particularly, I think it's very useful to get a very, very bright analyst like Juliette, who is completely unbiased in terms of personal politics, to look at this U.S. presidential election cycle. Juliette is a French woman living in London. She doesn't have, you know, the one side or the other American viewpoint. And I think it's so important to look at the presidential election cycle objectively. So I want to ask her about the election cycle and what it portends for markets. Listeners, we know many of you agree with us that we're the best financial podcast on the internet, because that's what iTunes and Apple Podcasts used to say about us. Unfortunately, we haven't been reminding you to do those ratings and reviews, which keep us in our number one slot, which we really feel like we deserve. And by the way, that's what helps us get the very best feature guests to come on the program. So your ratings and reviews really do help us to get better feature interviews for your future listening pleasure. Writing a 5-star review for Macro Voices is simple. The instructions, step by step, are in your research roundup email. This episode was made possible by TopTradersUnplugged.com. In recent weeks, we've been reminded of the fragility of world financial markets and how quickly sentiment can shift from risk on to risk off. Once again, the mantra of buy the dip and the determination of central banks will be put to the test. But as Chris Cole recently told us, the best approach to investing in the long run is very different from what's worked best in recent decades. To help Macro Voices listeners navigate an uncertain future, Niels Kastrup-Larsen, host of the Top Traders Unplugged podcast, has created a guide to the best investment books of all time. You can get a free copy at toptradersunplugged.com/macro guide. And be sure to listen to my full-length interview with Niels Kastrup-Larsen on trend following. The download link is in your research roundup email. Check out toptradersunplugged.com today. You'll be glad you did.
Well, Eric's interview with Juliette is coming up as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
And now with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me now is JDI Research founder Juliette DeClercq. Juliette has prepared a slide deck to accompany today's interview. Registered users will find the download link in your research roundup email. If you're not yet registered at macrovoices.com, just go to our homepage, look for the red button that says Looking for the Downloads right above Juliette's picture. Juliette, it's great to have you back on Macro Voices. It's been too long. Now, I know we usually talk about Europe and some of the things that you specialize in, but I also know from reading some of your work that you're actually focused primarily right now on the U.S. presidential campaign. So tell us a little bit about what your prognostications are. What do you see? It's great to have an outsider's perspective on what we can expect in this election.
Hi, Eric. So it's a pleasure for me as well to be back on your show. So with the COVID crisis largely fading away in the United States, I was not really surprised to see Trump catching up to Biden. After all, I think everybody thinks that the ace up Trump's sleeve is really the economy. And of course, it's not my personal opinion. My personal opinion is that short-termism and obsession for rising equities and basically financialization of the economy will eventually cost the U.S. economy greatly in the long run. but I have no vote in that contest. And clearly, his personal trademark is that of a businessman who can drive the economy back to prosperity rather than bankruptcy. So undeniably, the reason this year's events have not permanently damaged Trump is the V-shaped asset recovery. So my bet is that we will not hear about firing Powell for a while now. There's a bigger question mark, though, because job-wise, we've only recovered to the worst of the global financial crisis, with year-on-year hours worked still down 7.5%. And that was basically the worst we've seen in the last crisis. So will Americans look at the NASDAQ all-time highs and their lack of jobs and suddenly realize that they've been duped all along? If you have a continued slump in equities on top of a shallow jobs recovery, which is what we're seeing right now into the election, I think it will be game over for Trump. Economically, e.g. in real life, I would say that the issue we have today is that is the loss of additional unemployment benefits from the end of July. I think those unemployment benefits were withdrawn much too fast and clearly a lot faster than employment could recover. This is literally threatening to pull the rug out from under the hardest hit after the COVID crisis. The risk is one that I'm really highlighting on chart one of my chart package. And you can see here that we might end up having income expectations converge down to the level of unemployment and therefore the potential for a deflationary loop, instead of employment converging to higher income and demand expectations, which really is the only path to a sustainable recovery. Of course, that's a circular issue, which is well illustrated on my chart. But it's really what I want to say here is that income subsidies and a continuation of social subsidies is really an essential at this point. If you look at what we've had in Europe, and that's on top of already the generous social benefits in normal time. So you look at Germany, they've agreed to lengthen the job protection program, which covers 80% of wages until the end of 2021. France has also introduced a furlough program, and that could last up to 2 years. Spain has basically gone all the way to extend its furlough scheme indefinitely. And I think it's really this lack of fiscal cliff in Europe that's allowed consumer confidence to slowly but surely recover, and that's despite the current resurgence of COVID cases in Europe. To the contrary, what you've seen in US is the fading of the COVID crisis starting from August, and that's not really allowed consumer confidence to continue higher at all. In fact, what we've had in August, and you can see that through conference board numbers, which I will be looking forward to in the future, is that we're actually making new laws in August. And I think it's got everything to do with the expiry of the CARES Act employment subsidy. So one would argue that Trump promised an extra $300 per week versus $600 before by executive order. But for me, that's really a short-term bridge that's also quite flimsy. So my conclusion here is really that it's absolutely crucial for Trump and probably for markets as well to see consumer confidence rise from here, and that we should not be seeing allowing for a continuous slide. Some will argue that the employment benefit is a double-edged sword because keeping workers on a drip alleviates short-term pain and it does boost confidence levels, but it also delays the reallocation of labor resources. I would completely agree with that, but it's really a fine line. And the key to my view here is that it's really too early to pull the plug on employment subsidies because employment has only just recovered to the worst of the global financial crisis.
Juliet, so why have the Republicans not yet folded on the next relief package?
So that's a great question. And I think it's really on everyone's mind. There's two possibilities. Perhaps Trump is complacent because he actually believes that the regular new equity market highs up until recently accurately mirror the state of the economy. In this case, I would say that we're probably going to see a compromise on the relief bill, perhaps somewhere between $1 and $2 trillion, which is what the Democrats want. And that could be just around the corner on the recent tightening in financial conditions. The other possibility, of course, is that he will just wait until just before the elections to send the second round of checks to households signed with his name. It's also possible that he does believe that the executive order fills the fiscal gap until 2021. But in my mind, that would be a miscalculation. I think short-term delays in payroll taxes, which is what's happening right now, and on which, by the way, companies are reluctant to cooperate. And also the extension in wobbly employment benefits, where states really lack the firepower to deliver. Well, that really pales in comparison to the 5 to 10% fiscal stimulus, which is really necessary to drive the US back towards full employment. So if it's the case that, you know, there is complacency about what is really needed into 2021, then I'm afraid I think it will cost him the election.
So it sounds like you're 50-50 on the outcome here. No real clear view as to what's likely to happen.
You know, I actually spent considerable time studying polls and digesting the best political analyst research. I would say that my conclusion is that it's really too close to call, which might be a problem in itself, of course. My best guess is that if Trump ends up accruing the benefit of a fiscal relief package, so before the election, then it's really 50-50. But perhaps more importantly for markets, which after all is my job, my job is not really to call the election, but to call markets over the election. It might be a bit controversial to say this, given how polarized the population is in the United States. But my belief is actually that neither potential president is a short-term game changer as far as the economy is concerned. What I've learned through years of experience analyzing underlying macro trends in relation to markets is that macroeconomics almost always wins over politics. And what I mean by macroeconomics, I mean the underlying macro trends. And that's especially true in developed markets. Political events generally create noises and end up offering investment opportunities, but they rarely, like really rarely, are medium-term market drivers themselves. So think about it. The truth is that both candidates want a fiscal stimulus. I think they will have different fiscal stimulus. But what really is true is that they want it and they want to own it, which is why we have the fighting in the election campaign. So reflation is very much the name of the game, whoever is elected, and perhaps even more so if financial conditions tighten. And that's because the remedy to an equity route and tightening in financial condition will be strongly biased to the fiscal side, now that the Fed is effectively just a liquidity facade. So that's the reason why my A trade remains paying 10-year US breakevens. So 10-year breakevens, just to remind your listeners, is basically being long real yields and short nominals. And that effectively gives you a position on inflation as priced by markets. They've actually been trending higher since I almost nonstop, since I recommended the trade at 1% at the end of March. Against conventional wisdom, fixed income is not a dead asset class, but one where you really have to embrace trading tips or real yields this year if you want to express a macro view in the fixed income asset class. So in short, my view on the election is that Trump is more friendly to corporate earnings, and that's potentially great for equities short term, but eventually the lack of aggregate demand risks stopping the recovery right in its track. And that's what we've seen in his first mandate. that will eventually be an issue as well for assets. Biden stands for social stability and more redistribution. It would greatly benefit aggregate demand in the long run, and that's a main challenge globally, but also especially in the US. But it would also potentially justify increased volatility as far as equities are concerned in the short term on the potential for higher corporate taxes and potentially increased regulation. The risk with Trump is a return to trade wars eventually, which would most likely also include Europe, and that would risk slowing the dollar slide and stopping the global recovery in the process. But for me, that's really tomorrow's story rather than today's story. I really don't see Trump going back to tariff at a time when the global recovery is so fragile and really risk sending back the US into the abysses of the crisis, into like a double dip. Conversely, Biden would lower the world's geopolitical temperature and accelerate the recent cyclical recovery through further fiscal stimulus, which would widen the US trade deficit and further accelerate dollar downside. So I guess really your perfect market outcome would be Biden at the wheel with a Republican Senate preventing a tax hike. But what really matters for me right now is that the US and the global economy are still gaining momentum, with central banks heavily focused on increasing asset purchases. And that's really the main message that I want to get across.
Juliet, I wanted to start with your perspective on the elections, but what I'd like to do now is describe my own perspective on it to you and get your reactions, because something I'm finding very interesting, I guess I see this differently than most analysts. The vast majority of smart people that I follow are saying something very similar to what you've said today, which is, boy, this is hard to tell the outcome in terms of what it's going to mean for markets at this point, because it does kind of look 50-50 in terms of the poll odds. I see it very differently. I think there's about an 80% certainty as to what the outcome is going to be. And the outcome that I'm talking about is the one in which almost everybody in the United States is in agreement that their candidate won the election. Not should have won, but did win. My guy won. And anybody who says the other side won is trying to undermine democracy. And that's fighting words, and I'm not going to stand for it. So what I see, and I don't see how we could possibly avoid it, is a situation where you have almost everyone certain that their side won, neither side is willing to concede, and you've got everything tied up in a major Supreme Court battle between Election Day and Inauguration Day, and nobody is sure who the president is or who the president-elect is. Now, that's obviously an extreme view, but frankly, I think it's pretty darn clear that that almost has to happen. What am I missing, or why wouldn't you see that as the likely outcome? And if you do think it's a possible outcome, what would it mean for markets if I was right?
Well, I tried to avoid this question because it's indeed a difficult one to answer. But you are absolutely right that it's on most of my clients' minds. Indeed, with such a close call, my understanding is that Trump may win on the night, but because a much larger proportion of Democrats vote by post compared to Republicans, there is indeed a really high chance that nobody concedes on the night, or even, you know, right up to Inauguration Day. And I completely agree with you on that. Inevitably, we will see a rise in violence. Some even talk about the risk of civil war, which will be a grave problem, especially given, I've just explained how, you know, confidence is such a crucial key to the outlook, and, you know, violence would inevitably undermine confidence and jobs in the prospect and bring back the spectrum of a deflationary loop. So this is important, of course, and it's key to a continuation of the recovery. All I could say is that I'm acutely aware of this, and the risk is on my strategy radar. This is another reason to probably add a long volatility hedge to my portfolio of recommendation. There is no question that there's a chance that the US election is an inflection point this year in global assets. However, the one thing I would like to really say here is that in my framework, such riots would be more likely to be the spark that starts a global fire. In other words, they would not be a game changer unless they came in tandem with a worsening global cyclical outlook. And on this, what are we really be looking at is the Chinese credit impulse, German IFO export expectations, the OECD diffusion index. They all tend to lead the global cycle by a few months, and they are still shining a green light. Well, if I'm starting to see those indices like showing the way to a loss of momentum into 2021, combined with riots in the US, that would certainly, you know, make me much more conservative on assets, and, you know, potentially could turn everything from inflation to deflation. So in other words, difficult to call from here, but it's clearly something that you need to have on your radar, especially if it's combined with a loss of momentum globally.
Well, Juliet, it sounds like from what you've said here and also in your prior answer, the one thing that we can probably agree on is regardless of which president is elected, or even if we're not sure which president is elected, one thing you can probably count on is we're eventually going to get to some kind of fiscal package. So what would stop a vicious cycle from developing where lower confidence leads to higher unemployment in the short term? And, you know, if we're going to potentially have a pause before we know who's president, then that's going to delay that fiscal package. That maybe allows even more time for a vicious cycle to get started. What are the potential consequences of all this?
So that really brings the Fed back into the forefront, really, and in terms of looking for who has my back in the meantime. Well, obviously, the Fed can't really help Main Street, but it can still, you know, help Wall Street. And we have seen now, you know, what happened this year in terms of like the deluge of liquidity that's already considerably loosened financial conditions. And that's something that you can observe for yourself on chart 2 of my package. As far as the Fed is concerned, we've seen a shift to flexible average inflation targeting and an associated de-emphasis of the Nehru, which is basically nothing short of a revolution. I really want to highlight that it's a paradigm shift away from more than two decades of monetary policy. In a nutshell, the Fed is basically moving away from a rules-based reaction function to a more discretionary one with past inflation misses and employment shortfalls, so shortfalls, not deviations. In other words, you only react to employment when it keeps you dovish. And that basically becomes the whole equation. So just inflation misses and employment shortfalls give you the whole reaction function with basically indefinite flexibility. Practically, this means that the Fed is looking to overshoot its 2% inflation target whilst completely ignoring Phillips curve effect. And that's really important because theoretically, this should avoid a repeat of the past Fed pro-dollar, massively pro-dollar policy mistakes when monetary policy was tightened preemptively, tanking inflation expectations and any chance of hitting the 2% inflation target in the process. So for me, really, that's a shift that should and could or should also mark the end of the dollar upward trend, because we could see real yields easily reach -2 to even like -3% in a recovery. So global financial conditions will continue to ease. But there's obviously a catch. The Fed is increasingly important to affect the real economy. And what's the point of having an inflation target and moving it around if you're no longer the master of inflation's destiny? And that's where the Fed's newly found flexibility will greatly matter. Because thankfully, in this cycle, the trickling down theory is the theory that basically pushes central banks to inflate assets in the hope that it eventually creates jobs and trickles down to the poorest cohort. Well, that's no longer the one in use, or at least not the only one in use. So the real macroeconomic earthquake is not just the Fed's revolution, but it's that fiscal authorities have plugged this hole by going direct or people QE. I've actually called it Casa de Papel. So it's the money printer. The money printer, which, you know, goes with direct loans to small businesses and direct financial supports to households. So the Fed has really just become a liquidity facade, and that promises fireworks and a swift macro revival. Think about it. Before, we had central banks all molded in the same school of thought, in charge of the underlying macro trends globally. This power has literally now been transferred to politicians because they are the ones that are controlling spending. So central banks are now just in charge of monetizing or not. Needless to say, with such a framework, that the Fed's new flexibility is a gift from the gods because it will be greatly needed to respond to various politicians' tantrum. The other consequence of a sharp increase in what I'm calling economic interventionisms, where fiscal policy drives underlying macro trends, is much greater volatility in the whole system. So one can no longer take financial stability as a given and be complacent. So forget about risk parity funds and their reliable yearly gains. I think what we will see eventually is central banks' independence be threatened as governments inflate their debt load away, or we're going to see their hands tied by much higher inflation prints and they're having to shrink the balance sheet, raise rates, and potentially crash assets in the process. My point here is that you will not get smooth portfolio returns and should not even assume that they're possible. Passive investment should, in my opinion, be relegated to the past. And my real recommendation today is be in charge of your investment process, invest in your education, understand every drawdown, because the macro landscape has changed radically over the COVID-19 crisis. And there's really no return to the sleepy past two decades, where the only trade in town was effectively selling vol in whatever form you could find.
Well, Juliet, thanks for your political and election perspective. Let's move on now to the U.S. dollar, an asset class that you've done a lot of work on and made some really excellent calls on in the past. I got to admit, I'm completely baffled here because I can make a very strong macro argument for why the dollar should appreciate with flight to safety trades and so forth. We've got a global pandemic. There's a lot of good reasons to be dollar positive, except for, you know, little minor things like the impending threat of a civil war in the United States, which I certainly don't think is a high probability outcome, but it's actually a realistic possibility for the first time in my life. Is this dollar positive or dollar negative or dollar volatility or what?
So, really, for me, the dollar outlook fits almost perfectly into the inflation outlook. I think what will drive the dollar going forward is the Fed and U.S. fiscal authorities' ability to debase the dollar through higher inflation. And I should probably add not only their ability, but also their willingness. But I think that at this point, there is no question about the willingness from the Fed and the U.S. fiscal authorities to debase the dollar. As I like to say, as a central bank, you can't just talk the talk, but you must also walk the walk. Well, in today's macro framework, the Fed is the only developed market central bank with the ability to just do this by breaking the link between forward US interest rates and a recovering outlook. This is really an unprecedented break in years of a really tight correlation that you can observe for yourself on chart 3 of my chart package. This is something the ECB or the BOJ do not have the luxury of doing. They cannot loosen domestic financial conditions by keeping the curve flat for the good reason that their respective yield curves were already as flat as a crepe before the crisis hit. So we really have a divergence between what the Fed can do and what other central banks can do. The second thing is that even if European countries finally got their act together in issuing euro bonds, and they're basically unlocking the fiscal side, we'll still have the so-called frugals dragging their feet on spending. What it means is that cooperation between the US fiscal authorities and the Fed is potentially much more powerful and potent in terms of generating inflation than their counterparts in Europe or Japan, which means that you shouldn't be looking at nominal yields driving the dollar going forward, but real yields, and whoever can generate the most inflation and debase their currency is going to be the one winning, you know, a sort of FX war. So I really think it's no surprise to hear Fed members crumbling to call for forgetting deficits for now. What I mean here is that US real yields may well collapse further, possibly towards like minus 2.5%. I wouldn't rule out minus 3%. And that the ECB and BOJ will be much better at preserving your purchasing power. Not because they want it, but because they have no other choices. So, and if you look at Euro and Japan real yields, they're already much higher than US real yields. And in fact, Japan real yields are positive, and you could argue quite attractive. The last thing I would like to add is that all the ones who have called for the dollar to, who have rightly called for the dollar to weaken, you know, in the past 3-4 months, have mostly now recommended to take profit, whether because the ECB will resist the move or because they consider that the adjustment has happened. For me, this is really completely the wrong way to look at things, because the dollar is literally a momentum animal. You can see that on the chart 4 that I'm providing in the chart pack. Dollar upside momentum has literally collapsed, and I think that's really a game changer, because the dollar is an object in motion that stays in motion. And the reason, I'll explain it shortly, is that it's the world's reserve currency. Basically, that means that a dollar move is self-reinforcing, and it gives, it basically changes the trend and gives this trend a staying power. Why? Because it's involved in a large majority of transactions globally. So that literally means that a dollar decline increases global liquidity, loosens financial conditions abroad, and especially in emerging markets, where funding vulnerabilities improve linearly with lower dollar prices. We obviously also get, you know, higher commodity prices worldwide and rising global prices. And that also means domestically that import prices will increase. My point here is that the dollar is a heavily counter-cyclical asset, as you can verify for yourself on chart 5. So the looser global financial conditions improve the cyclical outlook. And in turn, it also weakens the dollar in a move that becomes almost self-fulfilling. So to the question, I've seen many commentators saying that, you know, Christine Lagarde looked a bit soft on pushing back against euro strengths and effectively dollar weakness at the last ECB meeting. I would reply that it's completely the wrong narrative. I think she was soft on purpose because she knows that global financial conditions are much more important, even in Europe, than domestic financial conditions. In other words, a broad dollar slide is much more beneficial to European growth than a one-off 10% euro devaluation. And the same goes for Japan. In other words, I really think that the ECB's failure to answer to the recent euro appreciation is intentional and part of what we may call in a few months the Plaza Accord 3 or something. But I really think that the dollar slide has only just started, that it's not only the way forward, but the only way forward. And I think really all the main central banks are going to be jumping on board and not push back except for smoothing the trend. You're probably going to be asking on my view on risk in general. I'll say that as far as stocks are concerned, even after the recent 5 months rally, I still don't really see valuation as an obstacle to much greater gains. What I think, though, is that we need a much broader leadership for the move to remain sustainable. And I think that's what really is happening in the past 2 weeks. I think we could see the rally rotate to become more centered on cyclicals and also non-US stocks, because relative valuations are completely out of whack with my view of a strong cyclical and earnings recovery into 2021. If you add to that view of a earnings recovery, my view that real yields will continue to fall, and that will basically keep multiples elevated. I think the greatest risk still at this point is perhaps to be too conservative into the election because of higher volatility and get caught naked, e.g. having to chase financial assets higher. But the message that I really want to come across and that I will repeat here is that this view could change quickly because we're headed to a much more unstable macro environment.
Juliet, I want to come back to what you said about U.S. real yields possibly collapsing further down toward -2.5 to -3%. Give us a little bit more color both on when you say real yields, obviously that's the nominal yield adjusted for inflation. What kind of nominal yields? Are you talking about, say, the U.S. 10-year going negative and that's how we get after inflation to that -2.5? Or are you saying inflation grows to the point where positive yields on a nominal basis still result in a -3% on a real basis because the inflation is running higher than 3%?
So what I'm talking about is basically nominal staying capped by, you know, whether it's going to be QE, whether it's going to be YCC, or whether it's going to be really strong forward guidance, which I expect will be announced tomorrow. So literally, like, you know, 10-year yields capped below 1%. And I really see real yields collapsing on inflation going higher. So if you just get the Fed managed to overshoot its inflation target, we're talking about potentially like 2.5%. So that would basically take real yields down to 2%. But obviously what they want is actually to overshoot. So you could get to like 3% on 10-year breakevens with like nominals still below 1. That takes you closer to 3%. And obviously, you know, all I'm seeing and you know, I can't show you like all my charts here, but what I'm saying from the end of this recession is much stronger inflation trends than we have seen in the past, which is really completely in agreement with my view that the macro landscape has really been revolutionized. And that's really on the back of central banks not being in charge anymore, but governments, and obviously that's the door open to overshoots.
Juliet, before we close, I know that at JDI Research, you primarily focused on institutional clients only when I first met you, but I know you've actually got several high net worth families and family offices who are Macro Voices listeners that are now subscribing to your product. So tell us a little bit more about what you do, who it's for, and what's involved.
Yes, so I founded JDI Research 5 years ago now. What's been actually really interesting this year is you can see a much increased interest from, you know, like high net worths. And I can, you know, certainly see that a lot of Americans particularly are at home, you know, ensuring that their retirement is going to be sufficient. So there has been a move away from just institution to like a more personal advisory. What I do really is publish reports that help you navigate markets with you know, very specific recommendations that, you know, this year have been quite successful, and I'm quite proud to see that my framework is continuing to produce exceptional returns. If you want to get in touch, you can reach me at juliette.declercq@jdiresearch.com, or you can visit jdiresearch.com website and contact us through there. As usual, I'll make a small effort of an offer for Macro Voices listener, and that's something I only do once a year. So really, all I can say is get in touch to see if our interests can converge.
Juliet, thanks so much for a terrific interview. Patrick Ceresna and I will be back right after this message from our sponsor. Farmland investing has been a popular macro trend among billionaires and big institutions for the last decade. But the high cost of buying an entire farm put this asset class out of reach to all but big institutions and the ultra-rich. FarmTogether.com allows any accredited investor to invest in fractional ownership of several different categories of farmland. I recently did a full-length interview with FarmTogether.com founder and CEO, Artem Milinchuk. We discussed the macro argument for farmland investing, performance and correlation comparisons to conventional asset classes, and the different types of farmland and their investment characteristics. If you're an accredited investor, I recommend that you listen to that interview and learn why farmland investing might be a fit for your portfolio. You can find the download link in your Research Roundup email, or just type the word farmland into the search box on our homepage at macrovoices.com. Check out farmtogether.com today. You'll be glad you did.
Macro Voices is a listener-driven program. Please email requests for specific future interview guests to requests@macrovoices.com. We also welcome your suggestions for how we can improve the program. Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Eric, it was great to have Juliet back on the show. And, you know, when she started talking about break-evens and the idea that real yields could see, you know, -2, -3% levels, it really resonated with me because I've had a lot of the similar views in this kind of bigger financial repression regime that we're moving into. And so it just was really nice to see her perspective on that. What did you take away from the interview?
Well, Patrick, I picked up on the same conversation that you did, and I think she actually said -3.5% on negative real yields in the United States. Of course, my first reaction as a gold bull is to say, okay, nothing is better for the gold market than negative real returns, negative real yields. So it certainly portends a very positive message for gold, and I think her logic is really spot on. The U.S. 10-year, I don't know if it can go negative, but I agree with Juliet that there's a lot of policy reasons that they're not going to let it go back up a lot. They really can't afford to, and it is within the Fed's control to stop that from happening. Now, the usual argument for why they wouldn't be able to stop it is they have to let it go higher in order to prevent inflation from running away. The thing is, the Fed's not afraid of inflation. The Fed is wishing for inflation. So I think she's right about that, and I think she's right that inflation will pick up. Remains to be seen how long that will take. Meanwhile, Patrick, I want to move on now to your post-game chart book, which is titled, Is That the Best the Bulls Could Do? Listeners, you'll find the download link in your Research Roundup email. If you don't have a Research Roundup email, just go to our homepage, macrovoices.com. Look for the red button that says Looking for the Downloads just above Juliet's picture. Patrick, let's look at this S&P 500 chart. Was that the best the Bulls could do?
Well, you know what? We talked about the bounce at the 50-day moving average, and almost always there's a buy-on-dip reflexive rally that typically happens at key oversold moments on intraday markets. I was expecting there to be even a rally that could have gone up to 3450 to 3500 on a quick reaction. Instead, the rallies kept getting faded. Even the initial strength that came on after the Fed meeting was almost immediately hammered to the downside. That type of price action usually suggests that there's more selling to come and that the distribution cycle is not fully played out. Now, one of the things that I want to talk about in the theme here is talking about the big FANG stocks, the Apple, Microsoft, Amazon, Facebook, Google crowd. And really, one of the big things is that they've been very weak. We'll get to those charts in a moment. And there's a lot of people talking about rotation and saying, well, that's just an asset rotation and that we're going to move into cyclicals and other types of assets as they move away from these and that this is just healthy. But the thing that I kind of reflect on is like, well, that's not going to help the indices at all, because when you look at how big of a weighting the FANG stocks have on both the S&P 500 and the NASDAQ, I don't know how much a broad market breadth the rest of the industry would have to make up for the pummeling that would be happening if we continue to see distribution in the FANG group. And so just as an example here, you can see the S&P 500, 20% of the weighting isn't just the top five stocks that are all FANG stocks, essentially. And so it's such a huge market cap weighting. Even if there is just a sector rotation, I just don't see how the indices are going to be able to hold up in that kind of a rotation. When we go to page three, and you look at the NASDAQ, the top six stocks, which adds Tesla into the mix, account for 45% of the weighting of that index in just six names. And so to me, if these five, six stocks have started to sell, the indices have a lot more to go on the downside. It's just going to be so hard, even if we see those sectors like potentially the energy stocks or other cyclical mining stocks doing well, I just don't think it'll be able to help these broader indices.
Well, Patrick, I definitely see a story forming here, because if I look at page two, you know, the S&P 500 might have just barely poked below that 50-day moving average, but only on an intraday basis. You haven't got a close below it. We haven't got a confirmed signal yet that it's going lower. But then as we look at the NASDAQ on page three, okay, it's already today, got a closing print clearly below the line. That's a more of a tech-heavy stock. But if we then move on to page four, where we start to get into the actual FANG stocks, we've got entire candles below the line. So it seems exactly as you're saying, that it's the FANG stocks that are leading the way lower. And the FANG stocks, if they're going to be the controlling force in this market, you care about what they're doing. And they're already showing closing prints below the line.
Very oversold, but also incredibly weak and heavily distributed charts on all of the FANG stocks. You got Facebook breaking to fresh lows. The only thing Facebook's going to lean on is the fact that the June, July highs are all just below around the 245 level. So that with it so oversold, maybe they'll leave room for a little bit of a bounce in that area, but a very negative breakdown of this chart. And you can even just imagine that ascending trend line connecting all of the lows being violated and broken. It really does feel like some bigger correction in these NASDAQ and FANG stocks is underway. When we go to Apple on page five, break of the 50-day moving average, breaking that trend line slowly on the downside. You take Amazon on page six, same thing, breaking below the 50-day moving averages, has already broken its ascending trend line, connecting those bottoms. It's the same story on every one of these. I don't think we have to overtalk each one. You can see that on the Microsoft chart breaking down. You can see it on the Google chart breaking down. This does not look healthy at all. It really, to me, is saying that there's more for this correction. I mean, the bigger question, is this a correction or can it materialize into a far more ominous liquidity event that could actually really downdraft the market? And while there's always a possibility of that, I think still my base case right now is that this is just going to be a proper and deep mean reversion of this robust rally. But I mean, when these things take a life of their own, as we have CTA start flipping and all these vol targeting funds having to start adjusting positions and all the quarterly rebalancing that's happening in so many of these different portfolios, who knows how much selling pressure can really start to feed on itself, and if there's a negative feedback loop that kicks in, especially next week after the gamma pins start rolling off on the option expiry.
Patrick, let's move on to slide nine. Here's the Euro Stoxx index again. Boy, still right in the middle of that sideways consolidation pattern that really has been in place since the beginning of June.
Right. And I think this is the other key thing to watch. For me, right now, all we've really seen is a blow-off top of a lot of these FANG stocks that really kind of took the momentum of the Apple and Tesla stock splits and this kind of little gamma drag higher on the upside that was happening. And it kind of blew off and put some short-term tops in all of those tech names. But the broader markets have not broken. We haven't seen a big breakdown in the Russell. We haven't seen global equity. And this is why I put the Euro stock up here break. And I think that this is actually the canary in the coal mine to watch. the Euro stock or any of the other major global indices, because if this is just the NASDAQ stocks correcting and it doesn't spill into everything else, then maybe this is not going to be as deep of a correction as I feel it will be. But if we start seeing the developed markets around the world kind of catch the cold and start getting sick from the turning of these markets, and we start seeing the breakdown in the developed markets, I think that that could actually add the fuel to make this a much deeper and more pronounced market correction. And so long as these stay stable and trading sideways, this could just be a NASDAQ move. And that's why I think watching this into next week is going to be so important. With that said, Eric, how could we not put together a chart book without a couple oil charts here? So you also have one on the term structure. So let's talk about this. What's your thinking here on this chart on oil?
Well, as you've drawn in here, we've been above the 50-day moving average all the way since the middle of May, the end of May, and it's been holding very well. We've been coiling up, waiting for some kind of move. I've been anticipating a move down to lower prices, not because I'm bearish long-term, but just because I think the rally was a little overdone. We needed some kind of natural correction. I thought it would go deeper than it did. And as you see, yesterday we got right back up to the 50. That would be your classic retest the previous support level as a resistance level. I was expecting it to stop there and for today to be another down day. Now, today was the JMMC meeting, so it may be that this is a pop and drop, a false breakout back above that 50-day, all about to retrace, still to get to lower numbers. I was originally expecting somewhere around $32, $33 to be where the final low was going to be on this move before into Q4 as U.S. production starts falling off, catching down to the rig count, so to speak, that we would eventually get a move much higher. So that's kind of the way that I see the flat price chart. Now, as far as trading this, my favorite instrument is actually not to trade the front month contract because it's so volatile and it's so subject to a lot of gyrations when OPEC does their jawboning and so forth. So moving on to page 11, this is my favorite instrument for trading the long side of this market, which is what is known to futures traders as the Z1, Z2 spread, the difference between the price of December 2021 futures and the price of December 2022 futures. There's a number of reasons that I prefer to trade the time spread as opposed to the outright futures contracts, the flat price or the front month price, as it's known in the industry. The first reason is that, as I said, it tends to be less volatile and less subject to short-term disruptions. You get a little storm in the Gulf of Mexico, it's not going to have a really big impact on a time spread that's, a year and a half, 2 years into the future. But more importantly, Patrick, what this bet really is a bet on a move back to backwardation. And I'm convinced that we will get back to structural backwardation as the oil market rebalances after this crazy dislocation that we've had as a result of COVID-19 creating a short-term excess of oil, so that we've got too much oil, not enough tanks to store it in. I'm convinced that situation will rectify itself and we'll get back to structural backwardation, which is what makes this trade pay off. What I'm not convinced of is whether that's going to happen at much higher oil prices or if we might just get that shift into backwardation at current oil prices, because although on the one hand there's a lot of supply destruction leading to higher prices, it may be that we have some economic downside which tends to result in lower prices. Even if the price doesn't go up that much, I still think we get back to a structurally backwardated market, and that will cause this spread to appreciate potentially considerably more than the front month price would be appreciating in sympathy with it. Moving on to chart 12, Patrick, you've got a net gas chart. And boy, if you want to find one that the 50-day moving average didn't support it, I guess you found it, didn't you?
Oh, yeah. But what's interesting is that what's happening in nat gas and particularly the term structure, because this is the October 2020 contract, which last trading day is just like 10 days away. It's September 28th is the last trading day. And they're hammering it. But the whole term structure isn't selling. It's just the front month. And what we are seeing is that it's pushing the term structure into like super contango. And so when we go on to page 13, we can see just how big of a collapse this is. When we're just going out 1, 2, and 3 months out from here into the futures contracts, we still have nat gas trading almost at actually over $3.20. And so this is going to be an interesting thing as they roll it up. And so I asked the question, why is this happening? And what's interesting is that immediately I think back to what happened with oil, and I'm thinking that UNG ETF is still only rolling front month nat gas contracts. And I'm wondering whether this is the market basically playing the ETF role. What's your take on all of that?
Well, it could be that people are gaming the ETF role. That certainly is a favorite pastime of energy traders, as we know from the experience with the USO ETF. But I think there are other explanations here. You know, at this time of year, the reason that the later months are not selling off is we're coming into the time of year where there's going to be more demand for natural gas for heating, whereas the inventory that's available right now, because storage costs are so high and storage logistics are so complex with nat gas, it could be that the last of that summer gas has got no place to go. Nobody wants it. They feel that they have got plenty of supply, and it's just a short-term imbalance in the physical market. This is one of those things, you know, to be a gas trader, you've really got to understand the physical market. And most people in energy trading either become expert in this stuff or they have the wisdom not to touch it because they're not expert in it. I count myself in the later group. I don't know enough about nat gas logistics and storage concerns and so forth to tell you what's going on here, but it feels to me like it's about a short-term imbalance in the physical delivery market and somebody not having enough space to store that gas in. And speaking of making yourself expert in a subject, for anyone who wants to get more of Patrick's terrific chart books, he does this almost every day of the week, 4 webinars a week at Big Picture Trading. You can find information on how to get a free trial on page 14 of the chart deck. We're going to leave it there for this week's episode. This episode of Macro Voices was made possible by FarmTogether.com, making farmland investing a $1 trillion asset class available to all accredited investors, and by toptradersunplugged.com. Remember to get the ultimate guide to the best investing books ever written at toptradersunplugged.com/macro guide. For information on sponsoring Macro Voices, please visit macrovoices.com/sponsor info. Listeners, be sure to register a free account at macrovoices.com. The benefit to you is you'll receive our Research Roundup email, which provides you with all of the best free content that we could find on the internet each week, including downloads associated with our guest appearances, as well as, of course, our post-game chart books. Patrick, tell them what they can expect to find in this week's Research Roundup.
This week, you're going to find the transcript for today's interview, as well as a link to Juliet's slide deck and the chart book that we just discussed in the postgame. There's also a link to an article discussing JP Morgan's near-term risks for the stock market, as well as a link to a Bloomberg article discussing Bridgewater's recent losses. So you'll find this and so much more in this week's Research Roundup. So that does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners, and are always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. Now, for those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com or tag it with the MVRR hashtag on Twitter, and we will consider it for our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at Macro Voices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter at Eric S. Townsend and myself at Patrick Serezna. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the Internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.